Good morning, everyone. I'm Armando Valdez. I'm a behavioral scientist with HealthPoint Communications. We've been using touchscreen technology to do interventions for low literacy populations, Latino populations principally. No disclosures. This is our study team. It includes Marilyn Winkleby at Stanford. She's an epidemiologist, social epidemiologist. Susan Stewart, who's a biostatistician currently at UC Davis. She moved institutions. Maria Fernandez at UT Health Science Center in Houston. And René Salazar, an MD here at UCSF. This is a problem we're addressing. The current Healthy People's 2020 is looking at a goal of 70.5 goal for screening of colorectal cancer for the population. These are the numbers. Whites are 60, so there's about a 10% gap or goal there that has to be reached in 10 years. When you look at the end, Asian population, Latino population at the low end of it, there's a 15-17% gap between the goal and the stated levels. Excuse the little subhead there. I developed on a Mac. This is a PC machine. I always have these problems. I've just stopped fixing them. In terms of screening gains over the previous couple of decades, you see that the Latino population has the much lower, and certainly the lowest screening gains over time. So we focus on that particular population for our intervention. The goal is to develop culturally and linguistically appropriate materials for the population. And we're targeting medically underserved, low literacy, low income, Latino men and women. And again, you know, Mac PC thing. The target is to increase knowledge, to try to resolve misconceptions, to address cultural and personal attitudinal issues that they have, literacy, language, and absolutely health literacy concerns. We look for an appropriate technology for this application. And many of you may have seen this a while ago, but you know, there was that big scare about the Mayan thing. Geez, they ran out of room, so. When we develop interventions, we look at technology and the centricity of the technology. Is it going to be driven by the technology, as some of them are? We've got the mobile capabilities. Let's do a mobile application. I can't tell you how many times I've been asked to do that. And then also, we've got content. We need to get it to the population. Let's do that. We chose to do something that's patient-driven. You sort of build it organically from their needs and then bring in the technology and the content that you need for that population. And I have no idea what that is. So this is the model we work with. You know, where are they coming from? What is their prior knowledge? How do they define their needs? How to define or how do we understand concerns that they may have, different attitudes and so forth? And, you know, the bottom icons are literacy level, you know, multimedia presentation to make sure that the information is presented in sufficient and complete forms. And it's self-paced. There's a lot of learning literature for adult learning that says that if the learner controls the pace and the direction of learning, it sticks a lot better. So we built that into our interventions. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, the point there that's hidden by the word tailoring is one size does not fit all. So language, culture, age, and gender, you know, we try to tailor it to the individual rather than generically to the group. We grounded this particular application, the intervention, on health literacy paradigm. And the key to the paradigm is to make sure that the information is accessible to them, that they can obtain it, that they can process it, that it's cognitively accessible to them as well, and understand it. Sorry about that little N that dropped down. It shouldn't have. But anyway, that's a sequence. We want to make sure it's physically accessible to them. We use touch screens, no mouse, no keyboards, none of that stuff. And we use a lot of video and a lot of audio and a lot of social models and so forth to make sure that the information is indeed accessible, comprehensible, and useful to the population we're trying to reach. So this is a touchscreen. We do a lot of multimedia content, and I'll tell you a little bit more about it. But we think that this does enhance their ability to access the information. The screen gives us the ability for the user to navigate, to choose and pick the information they want. It literally makes information accessible to them at their fingertips. And it's an individualized one-on-one experience. It's not a group video or anything of that sort. And, we tailor the messages, and we use a lot of behavioral models. This is an example of navigation, the welcome screen. The individual can tell us their language preference, in this case, English or Spanish, their age group. Why 64? Because they're not Medicare ready at that point. And then male, female, there are important differences. And then they go into the actual intervention. This is the intervention with some branching modules, submodules, and all of that. That's stuff that just gives you an idea of whether we use animation, video, print, and so forth. You can't hear a thing, or can you? No. They were going to charge $80 to have audio to them, to our presentations, our PowerPoints, but they chose not to spend the $80. And basically, we walk them through. We just draw them a picture and actually an animation and walk them through and explain to them what the colon is, what it does. And so abnormal growth, polyps. Interferes with the normal function of the body, and that they spread to the rest of your body, et cetera, et cetera. So for someone that doesn't know what colorectal cancer is or where their colon is or anything of that sort, we just literally use animation to show them that. No symptoms, takes a long time to develop. So regular screening is really the only way to catch it early, etc.
Colorectal cancer refers to the cancer of the colon and rectum, but it is commonly called colon cancer. It is the third most common cancer diagnosed in men and women, and second leading cause of cancer death in this nation. Yet one of every three colon cancer deaths could have been prevented.
So I didn't read that. You can read it for yourself. But we do voiceover. All audio, all text that we use, we voiceover it so that the individual will have it accessible to them. And then we summarize with some of the key points.
That is why colon cancer is preventable. That's why screening, early detection, and treatment are so important.
So early detection, screening, early detection, and better chances for survival. This is a doc talking about risk factors. I won't play it for you because there's a lot of audio. But he sort of walks them through what causes, what increases risk for the individual. And these are behavioral modeling. In this particular case, and we took this from actual interviews conducted with individuals, her best friend died of colon cancer. We sort of played back that narrative. And the point is that, regrettably, they learned about the importance of screening through her sister's best friend. Real case. Gets a point across. Then we walk them through all the different kinds of tests. The stool test, sigmoidoscopy, colonoscopy, barium enema. Again, I won't play the whole thing because you can't hear it. This one I really want you to see and hear. Again, a real case. A man, we talk about women being nurturers and supporters of family, etc. In our particular case, we found in our focus groups that men often make it a point to be good providers for the family, so they have a couple of jobs. In this one case, this gentleman was, you can't hear the voiceover narration, but he was too busy working to support the family, trying to be a good father and all that stuff. He knew he had to get checked, but he didn't have time. He had to go to work, et cetera, et cetera. Then he was diagnosed with, pretty advanced colon cancer, and he talks about, what was I thinking? I should have taken a little more time so I could be around longer. And, you know, we make the image disappear, and just the voice says, I wish I were still around, I wish I'd gotten checked. It works very effectively with men, and I presume women as well. So that's an example of behavioral modeling. And then we walk them through a lot of different things that you can do to prevent it and to catch it early. In this one, we address the video. We address a lot of misconceptions. We found that some individuals thought that, you know, eating certain foods or, you know, certain things of that sort affects your risk. So we walk them through that to dispel some of those misconceptions. We did a randomized controlled trial to find out whether indeed the intervention worked. These are patient satisfaction ratings. We asked them whether they like using the kiosk, whether they understand the material, whether they can navigate pretty well on their own, whether they feel they learned a lot or enough, what we were trying to convey to them. And the last one is, would you like to use this technology to learn about other diseases? And the answer was yes. When I began doing this work in 96, I can't tell you how many federal and state agencies, you know, weren't buying the fact that we're using this technology for low-income, low-literacy populations. So why don't you just use the video? It's cheaper, you know, and there's a lot of materials available. We felt that we needed to do a better job of educating this population. When you look at the disparities data, this is where we're having the largest mortality, medically underserved, and that's where we wanted to go. We've been able to demonstrate that, yeah, you know, they're not put off by the technology. They can use it, can be very effective, and they want more. So this is a study. We empowered it to detect 11% difference between the two study arms. You know, reasonable sample size. We had very good retention rates, 83.6. And these are the outcome measures. We wanted to know whether they actually got screened, their behavior, and then if it changed knowledge attitudes, improved attitudes, and then was there any gains in self-efficacy. There were no significant differences between the two arms. Knowledge gains were very modest. We've done other work in breast and cervical cancer. We found huge gains. These were pretty modest. In terms of self-efficacy, virtually none. Screening behavior, though, and I'll talk about that in a moment, we found huge differences in screening behavior between the two study arms. We went further and wanted to do an attribution to what, you know, what is a specific thing that influenced their change, their behavior change. And if you look at the first row, this is the intervention condition, of course. There's no control data, but the treatment data is significant. We used a doctor being advised by a doctor or provider to go out and get screened. That was a modest difference. And then we used a CDC Screen for Life fact sheet that is no longer available in Spanish. We had to spend some of our grant money to go out and reproduce it and use it for the study. And you see that there were modest gains. So another way to look at these data is to... Whoops. There we go. So the CDC fact sheet, you know, about 25% of the individuals in this study, you know, responded and got screened. As a result of that, doctors or providers bumped it up about another 10%. The kiosk, one out of two persons involved in the study, you know, got screened. Then we, you know, we did a model, and we found that decisional balance, you know, was significant in terms of change. The last column that's significant is clinical site. I mean, we had two different clinics, one in Southern California, one Northern California. No significant differences in terms of gender, language, education, marital status, and proportion of their lives in the U.S. I guess we're out of time. We're okay? Okay, thank you.